So welcome to the what is no doubt the last class in this overview of Britain since the Romans. And I probably won't get up to the present day today, but if you remember last year, in those of you who were in my L3 class, I gave a kind of summary of Britain since 1945, and I will be putting links to the videos on the blog, and so they will bring you up to date. So today I'm probably going to speak a little bit more slowly and just arrive to 1939 or 1945 or something like that. And the idea then is just to put the centuries back into order in your heads. I'm recording these because I think in a year's time, when the exam is just a few months away, you might want to listen to them again, you might not. So the Industrial Revolution, which I looked at last week, showed us that when Britain managed to get the first factories and the first railways, this brought along a whole load of other firsts, including firsts in communication and indeed firsts in organisation, the first trade union movements, and so on and so forth. This was going in parallel with the first major industrial empire. There had always been empires, but somehow the British Empire managed to become the biggest one in history. A quarter of the world's population and a quarter of the world's land surface was the British Empire in 1914. And for a long time, everybody taught in schools, they told the British how proud they should be of this. And they have the map with the British Empire marked in red. Today, in my opinion, fortunately, people are not finding it something to be particularly proud of. And this is an ongoing debate today. Perhaps you saw last year, it may be the year before now, in Bristol, there was a big demonstration. And they took a statue, which was the statue of a founder of some important person from Bristol who made a huge amount of money from the slave trade, and they took the statue and they threw it in the river. And this hit the newspapers all over the place and caused an enormous, let's say, conversation, because debate is probably not quite the right word, enormous conversation about what should Britain do today about remembering the empire. What do we want to remember? And this has been changing over the last 50 years. So for example, today, if you go to Liverpool, or indeed Nantes or Bordeaux, you can see a museum of the slave trade. Whereas for more than 100 years, the museums didn't really look at this side of things at all. So the biggest empire, and empires in general are not generally based on the most loving and caring things that human beings can do to each other. And so it's a pretty gory story. It begins with the competition with Spain. Spain has got a head. It's got an empire in South America, which is pretty cool. And they did find quite a lot of gold. And so the British were kind of convinced that if they went and explored North America, not initially intending to colonize the whole thing, then there would be gold. There would be more gold. Now, they didn't find gold, but they did find riches. The very first British colony in North America was 1585, Roanoke. However, they all died. One of the reasons they all died is kind of interesting, because although they were going to form a colony, they were actually going to find gold. And so they didn't bring anybody who knew how to farm, or anybody who knew how to build houses. There was a sort of feverish side to it. So they all died. The second colony will be at the very beginning of the 17th century in 1603. Meanwhile, the competition with Spain continued, and 1588 is the key date here. 1588, when the Spanish attempt to invade Britain. 1588, what do you call it in Spain? I can't remember. The Great Armada, the Great Spanish Armada, where they tried to invade Britain, and they were. It's not quite clear. What was the military balance of power, but certainly among other things, the Spanish were very unlucky with the weather, and were destroyed. Yeah. Now this was a really important moment. I mean, if they had succeeded in invading Britain, we would be learning Spanish. Yeah. And so once the British had managed to repulse the Spanish Armada, Britain established for a long time its position as the best naval power in the world. And Britannia rules the waves, the song, you know, Britannia rules the waves, yeah, rule Britannia, Britannia rules the waves, a big patriotic song is about this, more or less. It will remain the biggest naval power until 1914. Until the United States of America. So that's a long time, yeah? The 17th century, the 18th century, the 19th century, Britain is a major naval power. And in a world where there are no aeroplanes, and in most of the world no railways, the sea is the center of power. So where are we going to? So the second colony in America is Jamestown in 1603. The colonies were only viable if they found some sort of economic base. Yeah, you've got to make some money, or you can't keep bringing people and going back. And in the north of North America, so around New York, which is not yet New York, as I understand it, where did the money come from? Fish and furs. Fish was a huge, the amount of fish, and this is also the case for France. If you go to Nantes, the huge fishing boats that went out to the Atlantic and came back, and they made a lot of money because there were so many fish, and fish is so good for you and relatively easy to preserve with salts. And so fish was a huge element, in particular cod. And secondly, furs. This is, you know, hunting furs, not necessarily bears, but raccoons and other furs. I mean, I'm talking about millions of furs. Yeah, this is still a very wild country with lots of animals. And because the clothes industry does not yet have factories, then furs are actually a question of survival in the winter. You know, the furs is a really important element. So that's where they made money from in the north. In the south, they were hoping to find gold, but in fact they found a local production of the Native Americans, which made the fortune of the south of the United States. What is it? Something very important to several people here. Tobacco. And tobacco was huge money, enormous money, but it was very hard to harvest, and they sorted this out by renouncing the idea of enslaving the Native Americans and going to find slaves in Africa. I'll come back to that in a moment, but just one other thing. The central part of the United States coast, of the east coast of the United States, were more the religious colonies. So Maryland was established by which religious group? Mary? Catholics. Mary. We like Mary, Catholics. She's our favourite saint. And Pennsylvania was established by anybody? Which religious group? Yeah, William Penn was the leader of the Quakers. So these are groups who are finding that in England, even though the Church of England is relatively broad and relatively tolerance, these are groups who are feeling that they're not going to have the space for their religious expression in England, and so, well, there's America out there, let's go and found the colonies. Of course, most famously, the people we often call the Puritans, who founded in the north. Now, strictly speaking, it's not the right word, Puritans. Strictly speaking, they are dissenters. The Puritans are the people who work inside the Church of England to change the Church of England to make it more Protestant. The dissenters are the people who think, oh, the Church of England, forget it, it's no good, let's make our own thing. Those are dissenters. But it's true that traditionally we call them the Puritans, who went to the north of what later became the United States. So in the south, the big money came from slaves and tobacco, and this was also the case of the West Indies, where the big money came from slaves and sugar. This is a slave castle on the on the coast of Africa, which was controlled by the British, and this is where they kept the slaves while they were coming to get them. Now, the slave trade I can't really tell you much of the history of the slave trade because it's just so horrible story of torture and murder that it's difficult to say. But certainly, if slaves were sick on the ship, they just threw them in the sea. And when they arrived in America and they sold the slaves, any slaves which people didn't want because they were ill, they just left them to die where they were, you know. I'm not going to give you a long list of horrible, there are many horrible stories, which is what, you know, what empires tend to do. However, let's be a little cheerful, because the slave trade, so which was huge in the 17th century and the 18th century, will also give rise to the first ever national protest campaign in Britain, which is the anti-slavery campaign. And in 1787 in Britain, in London, the anti-slavery campaign in Britain is one of the three elements which will eventually get rid of slavery. The first one is the slave revolts. I will tell you this in a moment. The second one is this campaign in England, very powerful campaign in England. And the third one is the economic changes which made it so that wage labour was going to make a more efficient and effective economy. So all three of those go into it. But let's begin with this one, because this is in Britain. And you can see that in 1787 was the founding of the Society for Effecting the Abolition of the Slave Trade. And they met in London. I think there were 13 of them. 11 of them were Quakers. So this is interesting, because in Britain there has always been a link, certainly until the 1930s, between minority religions, or I should say minority Christian religions, and radical politics. And this is not surprising, really, because the Church of England is the established national church which supports the hierarchy, because they're part of the hierarchy, so you can't expect the Church of England to be a really radical thing. And those people who felt that for their religious expression they needed to be outside the Church of England were also open to other ideas, socialism, Marxism and so on, or would work with these other ideas to effect change. Now, of course, there's no Marxism yet in 1787. And so they had this meeting of 13 people. So let's found the Society for Effecting the Abolition of the Slave Trade. You know, they went home and said, yeah, you know what I did today? And the wife is saying, you're mad. You're completely mad. The slave trade makes billions of dollars every year, or the equivalent of the time. For example, all of the mayors of Liverpool for more than 100 years made money from the slave trade. It's very important to remember that the slave trade, although it was horrible, is not at all to be compared with something like today, the heroin trade. The heroin trade today, this drug trade today, is a criminal trade carried out by criminals. The slave trade was not. The slave trade was carried out by the most respected members of British and other societies. So it's at the centre of the economy. So of course their friends were saying, oh yeah, there's 13 of you and you're going to get rid of the slave trade. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they're really quite impressive people in some way. It's a very long story. I mean, I sometimes give 6 hours on the campaign, but I'm not going to. But in any case, by 1807, there will be the abolition of the slave trade in the British Empire. Notice that this is the abolition of the slave trade. That is to say that people who are slaves, it's an affirmative measure, but they stay slaves. And it is only... So the new campaign, anti-slavery, started in 1823. And finally, in 1833, you have the abolition of slavery in the British Empire. And of course, when they abolish slavery, they pay compensation, but not to the slaves, to the slave owners. And a lot of compensation. I think it takes 50 years for the British government to pay back the debt that they get from this. A pretty horrible story, of course. And there's some of the pictures. I know I've already said I will put the PowerPoints on the blog, but I will. it's really true. So here you have some of the element. Between 1650 and 1860, approximately 10 to 15 million enslaved people were transported from Western Africa. So you have the West Indies here, sugar, and here tobacco, and in South America are other things. Tobacco and sugar are at the centre of it, because slaves are not stupid. So if you ask them to do sophisticated work, they don't do it very well, because they say whereas tobacco and sugar are relatively simple, hard but relatively simple work, which can be done by slaves because you can just oblige people to do it. As soon as you have work which requires skill, which requires more skill, that you can't do it with slaves, because they'll just fuck everything up, because they're not stupid. Excuse my language. Okay. So the second element, I'm not putting them in order of importance yet. You can't really measure the importance. But the second element, which was tremendously important in the move towards the eventual abolition of the slave trade, and one which is often forgotten, is the rebellions. And just a couple of dates. You can find them on Wikipedia. I don't have time to talk about them, and also I've forgotten most of what happened. Busser's Rebellion, 1816, in the West Indies, and also in the West Indies in Jamaica, Sam Sharp's revolt. And this is a statue of Busser in Barbados, and indeed one of the reflections which is going on at the moment is, sad to say, almost all English people have never heard of Busser or Sam Sharp. But everybody has heard of Wilberforce. William Wilberforce was a member of Parliament, a very honourable gentleman, who worked in the British Parliament to abolish the slave trade. But the story which has been given in school books has always been a little bit a white saviour story, yeah? That the member of Parliament in Britain, who did good work, and there's the very little been said about the slave revolts. Most slave revolts were not so famous. A typical slave revolt takes place on the ships, where the revolt. These are not polite revolts. Yeah, they usually fail. But when they succeed, it's because they kill all the crew except one or two to show them the way back to Africa. Yeah, it's not an easy situation to have a polite revolt. Yeah, it's a real war going on, and there's a series of those. Now, to go back a moment to the anti-slavery campaign in Britain, of course, most of the leaders of the anti-slavery campaign in Britain were middle-class white men, because you know most of the rest of the population were too busy doing other things. However, there were black leaders, and here's one of them, Alodo Aquiano. Now, he was born a slave, he fell into the hands of some honourable Christians who taught him to read and write and got him out of slavery. And he would go around the country at the end of his life. He would go around the country in Britain talking about slavery in detail. And this was an important part of the anti-slavery movement. It was a very ignorant age in many ways. I mean, when he came to Manchester, a lot of people said, "Hey, let's go and see that man speak. I've never seen a black man." So it was something very very impressive, and the fact that he could actually speak personally. And this is the campaign which invented this. This logo, this may be the first ever campaign logo, and you can see that it's a Christian slogan. Am I not a man and a brother? That's a black slave. Am I not a man and a brother? Now, you can see that it does appear as a little bit paternalistic. Yeah, the slave is begging the reader, you, the people who are watching it, to recognize that, as it says in the Bible, he is also a man and your brother. So it's not Malcolm X. Yeah, it's not a big, powerful revolt, but it was the first badge, if you like. And there was also a whole load of products that they made to popularise the anti-slavery campaign, especially in the middle classes. For example, they had sugar bowls, and it said on, "This sugar was not made by slaves." So they would boycott sugar from the West Indies and buy sugar from somewhere else. I don't know, but it wasn't made for sale. And it would be written on their sugar bowl, so that everybody who came to their house this is respectable 18th century bourgeoisie, would see, you know, don't buy sugar. You know, so it's kind of the similar thing to boycotts you see today. Okay. Right, so let's just whiz over to, and this is really a very, very rapid tour. If we whiz over to the United States, and we have then the beginnings of the American independence, and it will be in 1776, of course, that the Americans declare then their independence. So this is 1776. We're at the end of the 18th century, and the British Empire is in a rather contradictory position in a way, because on the one hand they lose the United States, which is, you know, quite a big loss for any empire, and of course they don't know that the United States is going to overtake them, but at the same time the British Empire is still expanding. In particular, they defeat the French in the Seven Years' War, and take Canada, and they are expanding in India, huge expansion in India. They leave the French with a little bit of India, Pondicherry, okay, and the rest they take over very gradually. The taking over India is very gradual, and India is very special as a colony, because normally colonies have less population than the metropole. But of course, India is a huge, and India became known as the jewel in the crown of the British Empire. Bourgeois sons went over to India to administrate the empire, and came back 15 years later with a huge amount of money, often in diamonds. The biggest diamond in the world, which is in Paris at the moment, was taken from India by one of the British administrators. It's a huge thing like this. I think it's in the Louvre, but it might not be on show all the time. So let's go over to that then. So the 18th century, on the one hand, losing America, losing North America, on the other hand, gaining Canada and moving into India. So let's have a little look at India as the jewel in the crown of the British Empire. Well, when it began, it was a rather unusual type of colonialism, because it was a privatized colonialism. That is to say that the British Crown said to a private company, a commercial company, you have the monopoly on trading with India. You have them. Nobody else British is allowed to trade with India, and anybody from other countries, we will fight them. So you have the monopoly of trading with India. This is in particular for textiles. Indian textiles, luxury textiles, were very much in demand. However, this was a rather, they established the East Indies Company. However, this was a rather unusual company. So it was a little bit like a series of colonies controlled by McDonald's. It was a bit like that, except that this was rather an unusual company, because they said the British Crown said to the East Indies Company, you may produce your own money if you wish. And they produced their own money, and here you can see East India Company money from 1808, and notice that on one side it's written in English, and on the other side in one of the Indian languages, which I cannot read. They actually, now, when you're a private company, but you're allowed to print your own money, well, that's not quite like a private company in a way. They also had an army. The East Indian Company had an army. So what they did is they occupied part of India, and then little by little they would take new sections, in particular when there was a conflict, because at the beginning India is a few hundred principalities. Local things. So they would take them one by one, either simply by arriving with an army, or by taking advantage of conflicts between them. And then finally they passed a law which said, you know, any prince who dies without a legitimate son, then Britain can take over their principality. In fact, by all means of violence and fraud, they gradually developed the control over India. And it's quite slow. Over 200 years, British India gets bigger and bigger and bigger. For a long time, you have a part of India which is directly controlled by the East India Company, and another part which is not directly controlled, but the prince pays money to the East India Company. If you don't invade us, we'll give you some money. Okay, and that kind of setup. This was a huge initiative. This is the headquarters in London of the East India Company. You can see that they're doing fine. And the opinion of the elites in Britain was that the Indians were happy to be under British rule. This was the general opinion. So there was a tremendous shock when there was a revolt. And indeed, in 1857, there was the revolt, which is generally known in traditional British history books as the Indian Mutiny, and in Indian history books as the First War for Indian Independence. It's just a matter of how you look at it. Now, the causes are quite complex. It's a fascinating story. The causes are quite complex. Certainly one of the causes was that in the 19th century, there was less respect for local Indian religions. In the 18th century, those people who administrated the British Empire in India said, leave religion alone. We do not want evangelical Protestants coming to India to convert the Indians. That will cause trouble. We don't want it. However, in the 19th century, when in Britain, evangelical Protestantism was on the rise, then there were missionaries coming to India to convert the Indians, which is quite annoying in a lot of ways for the local people. And so a series of different tensions, also that the high level of taxes, a series of different tensions came to a head and exploded over a question in the army. Most of the Indian army, the British Indian army, was Indians with British officers. That was almost all Indians with British officers. At one point, a rumour went round that tell you about the rifles at the time. What you had to do is you had to take the bullet, bite the end off it, and put it in the rifle. And there was a rumour went round that on the bullets were made, the cartridges were made with pig fat and cow fat. That is the two ingredients which would be taboo to the different Indian religions, Muslim for the pork and Hindu for the other one, I think. Now, it was a rumour. It was probably not true. But the reason that people believe the rumour is because little by little they've become to believe that the British were really bad news and hated them in every way. Yeah. This caused an enormous revolt, that several big cities were taken by the Indians for a few months. The British power in India was on the shake, eventually, however, the British won, because as you can imagine, their technology was somewhat better. The repression of the Indian Mutiny was really very, very heavy. One of the things they did, because in some of the local religions, it was tremendously important that your body be intact, because after death, God will send you somewhere else if your body is intact. So when they executed the mutineers, they attached them to a cannon and fired a cannonball through their body so as to obviously kill them, but also try to frighten everybody of the same religion in that they were being denied the possibility of life after death. They're very imaginative, the British, very creative, don't you think? Some really horrible things. However, in Britain, this was an absolute shock because they really had believed, the Indians are lucky because they are under these generous generous British overlords. And I was walking around Leeds Art Gallery a few years ago, and I came across this here. And this actually, it just looked like a tiger. It's all nice tiger. And then I looked underneath, and the title is The Indian Mutiny. And as you can see, this is Britannia. This is Great Britain killing the Bengal tiger, the symbol of the Indian revolt. And the reason that they're killing them is that the Bengal tiger has killed these nice white ladies Yeah, and I think we should say that this is not a completely objective view of what happened. Although, naturally enough, as you can imagine, when the Indian rebels arrived in a British town, they were not necessarily very polite with everybody. You know, it's yeah, war is a pretty awful thing. So that was the big shock for British opinion. 1857, a huge date, and the British opinion, huge numbers of parliamentary debates and so on. So what should we do with India? Obviously, something is wrong, and they got rid of the East India Company, or rather, they nationalised it. And so we have direct rule from London after. So the end of the privatised colonisation under the East India Company and a more traditional colonisation with the British government in charge of the situation. This took quite a long time. First of all, they established a government committee which inspected what the company was doing. And so little like, but eventually they will take control. And indeed, Queen Victoria will be declared not only Queen of England, but also Empress of India. So Queen Victoria will be Empress of India. And every time she went to India, she never went to India. She never went to India. She was just the Empress, you know. So. I mean, you can't go to everywhere. If I went to everywhere I'm Emperor of, I'd be tired. I've got to go to Lyon tomorrow. Okay. So, this is very, very quick thing. So let's move across the world, because the British Empire is so huge, you have to move right across the world. So let's move right across the world to Australia. Australia gets colonised in a completely different way again. James Cook, in the 1760s, is exploring the world, looking for useful places for the empire. That's his job. He hopes to find the great southern continent. That everybody at the time believes there is a great southern continent, enormous, full of riches. The reason they believe this is for some reason, as you know, in the northern hemisphere you have Eurasia, which is enormous. And they had this idea that it must be balanced in the southern hemisphere by something just as big. And most people believe this, and so James Cook's job in the 1760s was to find the great southern continent, which will no doubt have as much gold in it as South America, no doubt. And he didn't find it. He found Australia, but Australia is not the great southern continent. It is a great southern continent, much smaller than what he was looking for. Now, Australia had already been visited by the Dutch. This is why you have New Zealand. Zealand is a Dutch name. Other Dutch stuff. Anyway, James Cook went around looking, really just cataloguing. Oh, this is useful. This will be useful for this kind of plant. The local peoples are badly organised here. You know, just he was not a military. He was a military man, but he wasn't a. His job was not to colonise. His job was to prepare and to make maps. He was an extraordinarily good map maker. A few years after his death, one of his mates said to the British government, well, the French had just established a prison in New Caledonia. Said, oh yeah, a prison colony in New Caledonia. And the imperial countries in Europe were saying, yeah, where should we put our criminals? You remember, at the time, you could be imprisoned for many, many years but for stealing food. Yeah. And so the British decided that Australia would be a really good place to do a prison colony. It's a long way away. And in particular, Botany Bay, which is just next to Sydney today. And so, in fact, the beginnings of British colonisation of Australia is convict ships. They were prison colonies. And the British can get very snobby about this and think, oh, these Australians, they just come from criminals. And there's a very bad joke, but I must tell it you, of a British gentleman going into Australia, and at the border, at the airport, the policeman says, and do you have a criminal record? And the British man, oh, I didn't know it was still necessary. And so it's just British arrogance, but it is funny. After the first fleet in 18, at the beginning of the 19th century, Australia became a colony. And by the end of the 19th century, in the 1860s or 1870s, the Australian government said, hey, we don't want any more prison ships. We just want to be a real a real country, and so they became it, and mostly based on immigration, and also mostly based on getting rid of or treating badly the local Aboriginal population. And indeed, for the whole of the 20th century, the and you know something about this, the segregation of Aboriginals was extremely strong. And I think really you need to think South Africa to get the idea. In particular, in the 40s, 50s and 60s, they would send the police to Aboriginal towns, and if children were playing outside, they would kidnap them, and their parents would never see them again. And the idea was, well, we're doing good for the children because we're going to give them to white families who will bring them up in the correct way. This is called the stolen generation. It's a horrible, horrible story. And it was there was an official apology from the Australian government probably 20 years ago now. But there's a huge, but a very, very rigid, these are things that are difficult to understand. But I think if you think of South Africa, it was that kind of absolutely rigid thinking where there was no point in, you couldn't argue people out of it. So Australia, a new kind of colonization, because the local cultures were pushed out, although they did survive, and Australian Aboriginals have a better space in society today than 50 years ago. In New Zealand, it's even more interesting, because in New Zealand, the Maori, who had a slightly different view of the world, because the Maori had arrived in New Zealand 300 years before the British, whereas the Aboriginals had arrived in Australia 60,000 years before the British, and so they made a bit of a different fascinating story. And in New Zealand, even today, the situation is very, very interesting, where the Maori language is on the rise, and certainly if I was a New Zealand university professor, I would give my classes in English, but if I gave a conference, I would begin with two paragraphs in Maori. I would learn to present myself in Maori, and this is what when I went to even in Australia, this happens sometimes. But when I've listened to when I've been to YouTube and what's the word Zoom seminars in New Zealand, they begin with a couple of paragraphs. Everybody begins with a couple of paragraphs in Maori, and this is a symbol of an attempt to build a bicultural society in New Zealand. Now, is this possible? I'm not saying it's necessarily successful, but it's very, very interesting that completely different from anywhere else. So Australia and New Zealand, and so we only have one continent left. Going through the continents one by one, the last continent is Africa. And this is 1914, so be careful, I'm jumping forward backward because I want to give you an overview of the empire. And this is Africa in 1914, the height of the British Empire, and indeed the other empires. And here you can see how Africa is divided. Germany, France, Britain, Belgium. And Italy, we always forget Italy. And the independent, I think it's the Sudan, but I'm not absolutely certain. This division was decided, if I remember correctly, at the Treaty of Berlin. I think this is 1880, but I'm not absolutely sure. And they divided the world up, and there was no African in the room. There was no African in the room when they divided Africa up, and that's how it went. And this is the whole of the British Empire, probably in 1900. In 1900, yeah, New Zealand, Australia, India. India being much bigger, because India includes Pakistan and what is today Pakistan and Bangladesh. Yeah. Africa, especially this way around. Little bit in South America. The huge empire, which will lead to a number of characteristics of Britain today. One is the possibility, when life is going badly in Britain, to attract immigrants from other parts of the world. So in particular, after the Second World War, when the economy was going well and there was a need for a lot of workers, the British government sent people out to Jamaica and Trinidad and said, come and work in London. And the idea was come and work in London for a few years and then go home with some money. But the reality was not like that, which is also part of the experience of immigrants, because very often immigrants think they're going to go home. First of all, they generally do not go home, because, and secondly, going home is much harder than you think, because you have changed because of where you're living, and home has changed, and very often you can never go home. And so the experience of Jews and Irish is the general immigrant experience. You can't go home. This is the bad news, folks. You can't go home. This, as my grandparents found out. Which leads me to the last element of British colonialism and the British Empire. This is much closer to home, and this is the question of the colony of Ireland. The question of the colony of Ireland. Now, Ireland was very much Catholic, even after the Civil War, and one of the great campaigns of Cromwell was to go to Ireland and take it over. And so Cromwell has this contradictory position. Well, on the one hand, in Britain, he was the guy who understood how to get rid of absolutism, and it never came back. So, yeah. And so celebrated as a progressive. And on the other hand, partly because of his strong Protestant conviction that the Catholic Church was, in some ways, the Antichrist, he was the key of dominating Ireland. So they went to Ireland, easily defeated the local rebels, the local Catholic rebels, and transformed, took the land and gave it to the Cromwell soldiers. Yeah? And so if you look at the map of Ireland in 1640, and you see how most of it is owned by Catholics, and then 20 years later, most of it is owned by Protestants. It's been handed over. And that was the case then for many, many years after. In other words, several attempts to rebel, a whole series of attempts to rebel. Just one of the biggest ones is the 1798 Irish Rebellion. And this is a statue of the leader, Wolfe Tone. This is a statue of the leader, Wolfe Tone, in where? In Dublin. Now, the next huge event in Ireland is the foundation myth in Ireland. Now, when I say a foundation myth or a founding myth, you have to remember that this doesn't mean it's not true. Yeah, a founding myth is something which might be true, but it becomes much more important. So for Australia, the arrival of Captain Cook was true, but in Australian national ideology and feeling, it is far, far more important than it really was. And similarly, in Ireland, the founding myth is the famine. In the 1850s, there was a disease came to the potato, and most of the Irish population lived on only potatoes and milk. You can actually live for an awful long time on potatoes and milk. So it's a very good thing. But because of the domination of England, that was the case. It was monoculture. Only growing potatoes. Now, it's well known that monoculture is a bad idea, because as soon as you have a problem, everybody has a problem. This is why the sous le canal de midi, il y avait que des platanes. Et arrive la maladie des platanes en 1950. Ils meurent tous. So now they're replanting the canal du midi with lots of different kinds of trees. This is my holiday story. Never mind. Let's come back to Ireland. Yeah, so a huge famine, and a million people died, and a million people went to America. One of the things, and it also fueled very much Irish nationalism, because during the famine, there was still food being exported to England, because the corn, there was plenty of corn, but the local poor people could not buy it, and so it was exported to England. And this is very often this is generally the case with famines, that they are just as much political events as they are natural events. I remember hearing a journalist who had been to Ethiopia during one of the famines, and he said, people ask me, where do I eat when I'm in Ethiopia? He said, well, I go to the restaurant. Because, of course, the problem is not that there's absolutely no food, it's the problem is who can get to it. And so the famine meant that huge numbers of Irish people left Ireland and arrived in Australia, New York. It's sometimes said there are more Irishmen in New York than in Dublin. This may be true. And this is in particular important because in America there is a strong tendency to retain your family links. So, for example, my great-grandparents all lived in Ireland, but my family, we do not say, oh, we're Irish, because we've been in England for three generations. In America, it's not unusual for somebody in a similar situation, I'm Irish. Have you ever been to Ireland? No. Did your parents ever go to Ireland? No. But it's an identity that you can keep. The Irish don't mind. The Irish are very welcoming. If you want to be Irish, be Irish. I know a German woman in Berlin who became Irish. She just spent all her time, she learned Irish, she spent all her time with Irish people, and she just became, nobody knew she wasn't Irish. But in fact, she had no Irish links at all. It's just, you know, they're very welcoming people. And here, this little symbol is Danny Boy. It's a very popular song, and it's the song of a father or a mother, but I think it's more a father, singing to his son is leaving the country, you know, as people do to look for work in America, and it's if when you come back, I'll probably be dead, so say a prayer for me. If you know anybody with any Irish family and you want to watch them cry, you just play. It's absolutely this is why I'm not playing it to you. An extremely emotional story about watching your children leave because there's no future in Ireland. Okay, so that's kind of my. That's kind of the empire. That's my thing on the empire. And I'm going to continue with just a little bit on another question. Half an hour on another question. Let's separate them out.